This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a real pleasure for me to have back in the studio one of the most perceptive observers and smart, shrewd activists that there is on the left here in the United States. His name is Bill Fletcher, Jr., longtime racial justice activist, trade unionist. He also headed TransAfrica, the Caribbean and African solidarity group in Washington, D.C. And he's been head of blackcommentator.com as well. He's published several books. His latest one couldn't be more timely. It's called They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. Bill Fletcher, welcome back.
Glad to be here, man.
Well, this thing in Michigan that happened so recently, I wanted your take on it just straight up. So why don't you start with that?
Okay, problem one is that we should not have been surprised at all, and not even that it was Michigan.
So heartbreaking, though, that it
was
Michigan.
It's very heartbreaking, but I was on Al Jazeera recently, and I said that it's what we're witnessing with Right to Work is something equivalent to curare.
What's curare?
It's a slow-acting poison.
Oof.
That when it gets in your system, it paralyzes you and then ultimately gets to your brain. The curare dart hit us in the late 1940s. And that's when the Taft-Hartley Act was passed. And at first people thought it was bad, but we could survive it. But this poison has been spreading steadily since the late 1940s. And when you have a combination of a very reactionary law plus a labor movement that abandoned its historic role as an economic justice movement, you couldn't have a worse combination. And I think that what we saw in Michigan was first a miscalculation on the part of the union movement when it attempted to move the constitutional amendment on collective bargaining.
Because that got whipped. They lost something like 50, what was it, 50,
yeah, it was
742 or
that's
something.
That's right. It was, I would say, when I look at those stats, I'd say it wasn't terrible, but it was bad. But here's the problem. Because I think that such constitutional amendments are a good thing, but you have to lay the proper foundation. And I would argue it's not good enough to move a constitutional amendment on collective bargaining. Because, look, Matt, a lot of people don't know what collective bargaining is, which is why I wrote this book. They don't get it. So when you have a constitutional amendment and you have the right wing hammering away at the dangers that this contains, and when you have a shrinking percentage of the population in unions, you have a recipe for disaster. Then you have a failure to conduct internal education among our members and a lack of alliance building.
I mean, that's deadly. And let's just do the first part of that, the internal education of the members, because the exact same thing happened here in Wisconsin with the recall of Scott Walker.
Right.
I was horrified. First of all, I was not surprised that Walker won, because I had been outside of Madison and I had talked to people in communities that aren't as liberal as here, and I was getting a lot of negative feedback. And also, I was seeing the polls. The polls showed Walker winning. I tend to believe statistics when they come. Every poll can't be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And all the polls are saying, you know, Walker's got a slight edge here. And the horrifying statistic that came out afterwards was that 38% of union members in Wisconsin voted not to recall Scott Walker, even when he had his boot heels on their throat. And a similar thing happened in Michigan, where I think it was one out of three union members voted against this referendum. What is wrong with that internal education process then?
Okay, a couple of things. I think it was 38% of union households, I think. But your point stands that what has happened over the years, again going back to the 1940s, is an abandoning of internal education that gets beyond educating people around filing grievances. So you have the situation, and I see it in my own union. American Federation of Government Employees represents federal sector workers. And I've run across Tea Party people. And it's like, how can you believe this if you're a federal worker? And what's going on, Matt, is that there's this contradiction in a lot of people's heads. And in the absence of the union playing an educational role, people come to various conclusions. We may not agree with them. They may not be particularly logical, but they're not necessarily irrational. This has happened all over the country. Now,
that contradiction, I mean, I know a pilot, American Airlines pilot, so anti-union, but the union has been the only thing that's keeping them flying.
Right.
And how do you reconcile that or the Tea Party person who doesn't like your union, evidently, or unionism, period? Maybe he likes your union, but he doesn't like union.
That's right. Well, let's look at that airline pilot. So one of the questions would be, no, let's not look at the airline pilot. Let's look at baseball players. When Curt Flood, the St. Louis Cardinals outfielder, died in 1997, very few young players came to his funeral. And one of the things that was discussed subsequently is that the young players did not understand the contribution Curt Flood made to the introduction of free agency. I use that as an example because that's what I see across this country, that you have people, maybe your airline pilot friend is an example. Did anyone from the union sit down with him when he was first hired to talk with him about the history, what the union did, etc.? Because in the absence of that, what dominates is the American myth. That is, I'm here because I earned it, I did it on my own, I don't need anyone else's help.
And that, I mean, that's it. That's the whole myth of, you know, you made it yourself, and if you're failing, it's your fault. And
exactly.
And it's the whole frontier cowboy mythology that's so much a part of this country.
Which is why in the 90s, when I was at the AFL-CIO, and we did this thing called Common Sense Economics, it was this great attempt at talking with the members about the economy. It was phenomenal, Matt. We were getting it off the ground. We were doing trainers. And then at the pivotal moment, the funding stopped and the affiliates disengaged. Because one of the things that I find again and again in the union movement is, when in doubt, get rid of education.
This was up and down the line.
That's right.
The union stopped educating their members except on the most narrow.
On a very narrow.
This is what's in the contract.
Right. Or, you know, or thinking that education is a union newspaper or the website or a speech by the president of the union. That's not education.
What is education?
Education is discussion. Education is a dialogue with people. Education is not assuming that your members are stupid. It's assuming that there will be differences, but that we have to have a debate. Education is about introducing new information, challenging people, and helping them to create a new framework. That's what education is about.
But the Michigan thing surprised me because Michigan, the cradle of the American labor movement, Michigan, where their sit-down strikes. I mean, the brothers Ruther must be rolling over their graves right now. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah. Absolutely. But also Michigan is the Michigan of suburbanization. I don't think that there has been a major organizing drive in Michigan in quite some time. It's a Michigan that's very segregated. All of these things come together, and to the extent to which the union is not talking about this, other forces sway.
Speaking with Bill Fletcher, he is with the American Federation of Government Employees. He used to do education at the AFL-CIO. He's been at TransAfrica, and he's been at blackcommentator.com. You're still there, aren't you, John?
I'm an editorial board member, yes.
And he's the author of several books on the labor movement, including their latest one, They're Bankrupting Us, and 20 Other Myths About Unions. One of those myths is this myth about right to work.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you explore that myth and say what's wrong with right to work? I mean, the label itself is such a misnomer.
I actually love talking about right to work. because I think it's a marvelous example of right-wing PR. As you said, the term has nothing to do with the content. It was invented in the 1940s, and it was a way of describing a segment of the Taft-Hartley Act that provided that workers in a unionized facility were not obligated to pay union dues. However, those same workers would be covered by the union collective bargaining agreement and, in fact, were obligated, the union was obligated by law to represent them. And this is what people don't get. And I was listening to a Republican from Michigan say that this now the unions will have to prove themselves. If they're so good, workers will join them. But they're missing the point, consciously. The union is obligated by law to represent those workers. It would be the equivalent of a situation where you have a city that makes taxes voluntary. However, not just that they're voluntary, but people that don't pay taxes can access the police, the fire department, sewer, water.
Still get their garbage picked up in the street cloud.
Exactly. But they can voluntarily pay taxes. If a worker in a unionized setting, even if they're not a member of a union, is not represented by that union, it's a violation of the law. So what right to work is not about that. It's about war. It's about an effort by the right wing to destroy the organizations of workers. When you make it voluntary, it becomes a right to be greedy.
A right to split one worker against another, too.
Precisely.
That freeloader problem you're talking
That's
about.
That's right.
You mentioned this a war against unions, and I think a lot of people don't understand how illegal it's been. I mean, how chief executives and bosses around the country realize that the chances of them being caught and prosecuted and convicted and fined for firing someone who wants to organize a union on their shop floor, that the odds are infinitesimal, so they may as well just go ahead and do it. And they do it.
Precisely. The what's interesting and important for people to understand is that the law is so weak that it actually encourages an employer to break it, because there are actually no fines. There are damages. You have to rehire. You have to compensate back wages. But what you don't have, what you would have in other lawsuits, would be real fines, where you actually are penalizing someone. So an employer can fire a worker, keep that worker out, intimidate others, and maybe 2 years, 3 years down the road, they will be ordered to reinstate that worker and to compensate the worker for what the worker lost. But here's the trick. If that worker did not look for another job, they don't get compensation. If that worker got another job and made more than they would have made in their position, they are owed nothing.
And the other catch is the unionizing drive is over.
That's right. And that's what employers assume. I spoke with a capitalist once who, in his moment of letting down his guard, said to me, you know, when workers in any of my places talk about forming a union, I just close the place. And it was interesting, Matt, because he said this, and he knows I'm a union person, but he said it in a way that it was as if he was just saying that in the morning he'd have a cup of coffee when he woke up. He was not worried about the implications of what he was doing.
I mean, that's how brazen they've become, though.
That's right.
And the odd thing and one of the distressing things is the National Labor Relations Act put the whole power of the federal government behind collective organizing, encouraged people in the letter of the law to form unions. And we've gone so far from that in the last 70, 85 years now.
Right.
That all the power is in the hands of the companies. It's an amazing shift that's happened. You mentioned the Taft-Hartley Act. And then, of course, there was Ronald Reagan's firing of the Patco strikers in your book, Bill mm-hmm. Fletcher, they're bankrupting us. You reminded me that Jimmy Carter had had a similar firing mm-hmm. of, what were they, postal workers?
Postal workers, that's right.
And so you've had the power of the chief executive, both in Democratic and Republican administrations, behind these anti-labor actions, and then just the open season on unions that the corporate America has declared in the last, certainly since Reagan, but even prior to that. I know GE and a couple of the other big companies back in the 50s
That's right.
started to wage this war. I want to bring it back to Michigan for a second. And what do you think the immediate consequences even mid to long term are going to be of this right to work, so-called right to work vote?
I think that the first thing is that there's going to be demoralization. And then there's a very big question mark. If I were in the Michigan labor movement, I would at this point do two things immediately. One would be to begin a significant internal education program, explain to the members exactly what's going on, and situate it in a global context. I don't think this is just a Michigan context. The second thing I would do is I would lay the foundation for a massive electoral showing in 2 years that
take down the governor.
That's right. The governor and these state reps. And I mean, but it would have to be coalition building. And part of the thing that also has to happen as part of the coalition building is that we need to move what some people have called a rights at work platform. Something that Barbara Ehrenreich, the writer, has talked about for the last 12, 13 years, that, and I pick up on in my book, that the workplace is an authoritarian environment. But people don't talk about that. You walk into the workplace and you give up all of these rights, and people assume that. The union movement needs to be challenging that authoritarian environment, and I would argue that's part of building a winning coalition. So that would be part of what I would say if I was in the Michigan labor movement right now.
And who's part of this coalition?
Everyone that has an interest in economic justice. This cannot be the unions alone. This is part of what I would suggest to you humbly was the difficulty in the Wisconsin recall, that you can't fight the battle on the basis of what is perceived as the institutional interests of the unions. It has to be a battle about economic justice and injustice. It has to be a battle where someone in northern Michigan who may never have been in a union but is losing their home understands that this is a battle that they must join. It's not just about people in Detroit. That's the framework that we have to create. And in the absence of that framework, there's two dangers. One is very simple, that we keep losing elections.
Right.
The bigger danger is that falling into that void is right-wing populism that starts to provide a whole set of other answers to people who know that they're getting creamed but can't figure out what to do about it.
Mm. And some of those answers are anti-immigrant or racist or
misogynist. Yes.
How would you convince that person in the UP that what's going on in Detroit is also in his or her interest?
I would talk with them about the economy. See, I think that this may sound very abstract, but I actually, in my experience when I did Common Sense Economics in the AFL-CIO, I found that regular working class people were very interested in the economy and understanding how it operates and why they were getting their rear ends kicked. That's where I would start with that person in northern Michigan. I would speak with them.
So you talk about Wall Street.
That's right.
You talk about globalization.
I talk about the banks. I talk about exactly about globalization. One of the things that I do rhetorically very often when I speak is I ask for a show of hands on how many people are aware of companies that have been shut down by undocumented workers. just undocumented immigrants. Just a show of hands, right? How many shipyards have been shut down by undocumented workers, right? And I use that to raise this point. Well, if that's not the case,
because no one raises their hand.
That's right. No one raises their hand, and they at first think it's a joke. And then they realize, yeah, there's a little bit of a joke here, but I'm making a point about who the driving forces in the economy are that explain why once upon a time in parts of Wisconsin, we had a very developed manufacturing economy, and it's gone.
So you got to draw the picture for him.
You have to.
I'm speaking with Bill Fletcher. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Bill Fletcher is the author most recently of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the book in a second. He works at the American Federation of Government Employees. He's worked with the AFL-CIO doing education work for many years up to 9/11 and shortly thereafter, which he wrote about in the Progressive Magazine's latest issue called Living Our Values. And he's just about one of the smartest people around on these issues of a whole range of issues, including racial justice issues and labor issues. Let's get back to the book a second, because you talk about other myths. And here's one that I've heard in this same basketball game I'm in with that American Airlines pilot, which is, they're lobbyists, they're businessmen, individual entrepreneurs, and bankruptcy lawyers who wear pot T-shirts, legalized pot T-shirts and things like that. It's quite an eclectic group. But he said unions were good once, but we don't need them anymore, which is the title of one of your chapters,
That's
one
right.
of your myths.
That's right.
And so, and you talk about flying in an airplane and people either don't know what unions are or they give you the same shtick. And so how do you rebut that? Unions were good once, but we don't need them anymore. We got the 40-hour work week, or we got minimum wage, or we have OSHA or whatever.
It's actually easier to rebut that now than it was maybe 20 years ago, because many of the things that people say, well, we have these benefits, we're losing them. We're finding these regulations are being thrown out. They're not being enforced. You have occupational safety and health, but insufficient funding. Any number of things. So that's one of the issues. But the thing that I say fundamentally is this, Matt, that unions came into existence because there is a power differential between the employer and the worker. That power differential continues to exist. It goes back to what we were talking about before in terms of the authoritarian work environment. The employer can fire the worker. The worker cannot fire the employer. Therefore, there's this question right there about how do workers assert themselves? How do they ensure fairness? How do they ensure that they have some sort of voice? So on a very basic level, we need unions now more than ever. But the other part I'd say is that when people make that argument, we needed them once, they're often talking about the era of sweatshops. Well, I hate to tell you, the era of sweatshops have returned, not just in Thailand or Taiwan, but here in the United States. We have the growth of a manufacturing industry in Los Angeles that's garment and textile and light electronics, that's sweatshop conditions. So workers need unions now more than ever.
There's also, even on in non-sweatshops, there's forced overtime, which is involuntary servitude in my mind.
That's right.
There's no paid sick leave in most places in America, which is amazing. So you got to choose whether you're going to come to work sick or you're going to send your kids to school.
That's right.
Or whether you're going to risk losing your job. And you talk about this power differential. Here's a very petty example of it, though. Here in Wisconsin, where public sector workers have taken it on the chin, I just read in the paper, in Janesville, Wisconsin, where my wife grew up, and we know some teachers down there, now there's a dress code. I mean, they're imposing just, a petty dress code on the teachers. It's, you can't wear blue jeans or whatever. You know, it's just silly little petty infringements on people's liberty here in the workplace.
That's exactly right. And it humiliates the worker. It makes you feel more and more like a tool rather than as a human being. I mean, the issue, a union fundamentally is an organization of workers coming together to make sure that they don't get played off against one another, and to make sure that there's some degree of fairness in the workplace. It's very simple. And that is as useful for that airline pilot as it is for a sweatshop worker. It's going to look different for different sectors. That's the bottom line. And what we find is that in this environment, particularly since Reagan, there is a greater loss of control by workers over their work environment. There is a greater feeling of a precariousness on the part of everyone.
Especially when the economy's bad, too.
Precisely, which is why we need what my late friend Jerry Tucker of the United Auto Workers talked about as the need for a labor reformation.
Well, let's talk about that. We only have about 3 minutes left. How to get that labor reformation going, how to revitalize the labor movement.
One of the things that we have to do, we desperately are in the need of new leaders who have a vision that begins with an understanding that we have very little to lose right now in taking risks, that we are going to need to have a movement that really is fighting on the side of economic justice. And here's the example, the most recent example, the Chicago teacher strike. Mm-hmm. I think that the Chicago teacher strike was just, the leadership was just outstanding. Because mm-hmm. here you had a situation where the mainstream media painted the teachers as a special interest, predicted the destruction of this teachers union, that the strike would be a disaster. And instead, a reform leadership of the union led a strike, which became a strike about kids.
And actually, it was popular in the city
Precisely.
Of Chicago among
Precisely.
The parents and
among
the citizens of Chicago.
Right.
You wouldn't understand that if you read the New York Times or
That's
the corporate
right.
press, because they were just mocking the strike
That's
constantly.
Right. But you're right. And what that was about a different kind of trade unionism. This is the fight that needs to happen. And unfortunately, we still have too many leaders who very well-intentioned in many cases, but nevertheless, they're continuing to fight the last war. They don't realize that we have suffered two historic defeats. The first was in the 1940s, and the second was in the 1980s. The most recent fights here in Wisconsin and Michigan, I don't look at those as historic defeats. Those are the continuation of what happened in the 1980s with the attack that was launched by Reagan.
But it's an acceleration of the offensive by corporate America.
It is an attempt now. It is the final offensive. That's what we have to understand. This is not even what Reagan was doing in 1981, where he was trying to blunt the strength of unions. This is now an attempt to eliminate them entirely.
And we got 15 seconds left. How do we resist that?
We learn from Chicago. We build organizations that reach out from the very beginning and build broad coalitions.
We're going to have to get that work done because they're really putting the pressure on us.
They are.
Bill Fletcher, thanks so much for being my guest again today on Progressive Radio. It's great to see you again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.